Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
Richard Nixon resigning, brought down by the Watergate scandal. Many Americans are asking themselves today, could I keep a secret, one the whole world wants to know, for 30 years? 91-year-old former top FBI official W. Mark Felt's revelation that he is Deep Throat is captivating Washington. The secret source that helped Washington Post reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein unravel the Watergate scandal that ultimately brought down the Nixon White House has been one of the best-kept secrets in journalism. Felt had been on many short lists, and in fact, in a moment, we'll hear the story of an 8-year-old who heard about W. Mark Felt at summer camp from Carl Bernstein's son. But first, two reporters from the paper that relied on Deep Throat's information in its Watergate coverage. David Vondrelli. David, hello.
Hey, how are you?
Good. And Paul Fahey. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Robin. How you doing?
Both of the Washington Post. I'm well. And David, I want to start with you. We heard you were in the newsroom yesterday, and it was bedlam at the Washington Post. Obvious that the Vanity Fair was going to print the scoop that Bob Woodward said he'd keep secret till Deep Throat died. What was it like in the Post newsroom?
This caught us way off guard. I have to tell you that earlier this year, we had some very preliminary conversations about how the Post might cover Deep Throat's death. Bob told us that it was not anything imminent, but that he was a very old man and we should probably think about it. And so in the way that daily newspapers did, we started thinking about it way in the back of our minds. This story broke and obviously sped up our plans.
Right. Well, and David, could clear something up for us, because Bob Woodward had said that he would not reveal his source until the source died.
Yes.
And we understand now from some reports that he had conversations with Felt's family saying that they were going to go ahead. Did Bob Woodward ever come to the paper in recent weeks and tell them this was going to happen?
He did not know this story was coming out until he saw it yesterday morning, about the same time the rest of the world did. He knew that Felt had begun talking to his family, and his family was looking at this issue. When I talked to Bob several weeks ago, he expressed some concern that the secret was becoming known by more and more people, but he was very skeptical that Mark Felt himself, 91 years old, having suffered a severe stroke recently, was capable of making this decision himself to undo an agreement that they had had and revisited over 30 years, and so he was reluctant to change his policy simply because his Felt's daughter and son wanted him to.
Right. Well, Paul Fahey, you write today that many have tried to unmask perhaps the most famous whistleblower ever. Few have gotten it right. How did Vanity Fair get the story?
They got lucky, basically. What happened was they got a cold call about 2 years ago from an attorney named John O'Connor, who ended up writing, at least having the byline on the story that appeared in Vanity Fair. O'Connor had met the grandson of Mark Felt at a dinner he was giving for his daughter in Marin County, and the grandson of Mark Felt said, some people say my grandfather is Deep Throat, and John O'Connor, who's been following Watergate and had some connections with various Nixon officials way back when, got very interested in this and began to pursue it and got to know the family, and the family got to know him, and he became an advisor to the family, and eventually, or not long after, he called up Vanity Fair and said they want to come out. The family wants to reveal Deep Throat's identity in the pages of the Vanity Fair. And 2 years later, that's where we were yesterday.
Well, and as you both may know, and we are finding out, there are young people saying, who's Deep Throat? I mean, this is something that means so much to some generations and not much to others. So, David Vondrelli, just take us back for a minute, because this does take us back to shadowy figures smoking cigarettes in garages and flower pots put out on windowsills, as you write, as signals. What was the significance of Deep Throat?
You know, the hope of Bob and Carl is that Fitzgerald's real role can become clearer now that the mystery is revealed. He was basically the senior figure in the FBI at this crucial moment when the burglary of the Democratic headquarters and the Watergate Hotel was revealed, the botched burglary in June 1972. And initially, no one really knew where it led. Clues quickly connected the burglars to people associated with the White House. But the initial reaction of the Washington Press Corps was that this was a tempest in a teapot. The Nixon administration very aggressively moved, we now know, to cover this up, to use the FBI and the CIA to prevent the facts coming out. And Deep Throat, from his position, Mark Felt, was able to tell his friend Bob Woodward that no, this was a big thing. This wasn't a simple third-rate burglary. This was the standard operating procedure of the Nixon administration, that corruption was the order of the day, and that the Post needed to stay on this story and keep connecting the dots. Yeah. And so that encouragement helped them bring the story out.
And you write that Felt had the means and the motivation to uncover these dirty tricks, the motivation being that he'd been passed over to be FBI director. But Paul, remind us, because his daughter today calling Felt a hero, some Nixon allies, Pat Buchanan, Charles Colson, calling him a traitor. But the way it worked is that when the reporter spoke to Felt, they could not write anything he said directly, right?
That's right. I mean, what he would do was give direction, and he became a source on which Woodward could bounce ideas off. He would confirm information, but he never wanted to be quoted, even as an anonymous source. So it wasn't until All the President's Men, the book, that the existence of Deep Throat was actually known publicly, obviously within the newsroom. The editors and Woodward and Bernstein knew, but he really was a very reluctant kind of source. And in fact, the movie, I think Woodward has been on record saying that the movie actually did kind of capture his kind of reticence and the fact that he was in many ways very, very reluctant about what he was doing.
And David Draley, we just got a little over a minute left, but what's it like in Washington today, in the world that has, you know, spent three decades speculating about this?
Well, now we've got no secrets. We've got no parlor game. We're just back to business, and maybe this will inspire some young reporters to go out and find the next Deep Throat and the next big story.
Well, and as you write, and again briefly, this identification is also likely to encourage new arguments about the essential means of Watergate. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, there have been many attempts to frame the meaning of Watergate. What was it all about? Was it about Nixon's corruption? Was it about his obsession with the Kennedys? Was it business as usual? Was it a president gone insane? Was it a coup by the political elite, as some Nixon defenders have said? Now you're going to naturally hear people discussing the role of a disgruntled FBI immediately after the death of their founder, J. Edgar Hoover, their role in bringing this all to light.
David Von Draley and Paul Fahrey of The Washington Post, they both write terrifically today about the revelation of just who is Deep Throat. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, one person who's probably not surprised by yesterday's revelation that Mark Felt is Deep Throat is David Daley. In 1999, as a reporter for the Hartford Courant, Daley wrote that Deep Throat was Mark Felt. Daley is now features editor at Details Magazine, and he joins us on the line. And David, we understand that your source was, it came from a 19-year-old at the time who initially learned the identity of Deep Throat when he was 8 years old. How did he find out?
It turns out that everybody got scooped by a couple of kids at summer camp back in the 1980s. I got a call one day from a writer who knew about a boy named Chase Kuhlman Beckman, and he had been at a summer camp with Carl Bernstein's son Jacob in 1988, and Jacob had told him that Mark Felt was Deep Throat. It all checked out, as specious as that might sound.
Well, now, let's stop you here. I mean, this young man, Chase Coleman Beckman, 19 years old.
Yes.
What exactly did he say that Carl Bernstein's son said to him, I mean, in casual conversation?
Well, evidently they were these precocious kids who were talking about Watergate at summer camp, about politics. Maybe Jacob was showing off who his dad was,
mm-hmm.
That he was a famous newspaper reporter. And he said that his dad had told him and that he was 100% sure that Mark Felt was mm-hmm. Deep Throat. And, I mean, Felt had, of course, always been on the short list of possible names and possible Deep Throat candidates.
Well, now, David, did you contact the players? Did you speak to Felt, to Bernstein? What'd they say?
I talked to everybody, and I got a round of denials. But they were really interesting denials. They were the denials of people who still had something to hide. Bernstein, for example, said to me, "Is Mark Felt even still alive?" Because, of course, they had famously said that they would identify the source once he had died, and he pretended to not even know whether Felt was alive or dead.
Trying to throw you off the trail.
Yes. And Felt, when I went back and looked at his denial again yesterday, I think it really made clear that he was somebody who was pretty conflicted about the role that he had played in all of this. Felt said to me not only that he was not Deep Throat, but that if he had, he would have done better, and that Deep Throat had not been particularly effective. And to me, that sounds like a man who was still in many ways at war with himself and perhaps was still trying to tell himself that he had not done anything all that wrong that had brought down a White House.
Well, getting back to this young man who, again, was your source, you detail in your 1999 story that at one point he went to tell his mother that at camp he learned who Deep Throat was, and she almost drove off the road.
She thought he was talking about Linda Lovelace.
So this young man, Chase Coleman Beckman, you quote him in your story in 1999 as saying, "I don't know what is more far-fetched, for a kid to be privy to such a detail or to make something up like that." What an odd piece of information to have for him to
have. I think that was one of the reasons why I was willing to go as far with the story as we did. I mean, certainly it was, you know, slightly speciously sourced, and to put a story like this in the newspaper, we needed to believe that it was reasonable that this might have happened. And for, you know, a boy who was 8 years old at the time, even if he was Carl Bernstein's son, to be throwing around the name of a career FBI bureaucrat was a little interesting.
David Daley, features editor at Details Magazine Now, but he wrote an article in 1999 for the Hartford Courant revealing that Mark Felt was Deep Throat, his source, a kid from summer camp. Dave, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Robin.
Now, a reminder, here is Deep Throat, now known as Mark Felt, played by Hal Holbrook in the seminal film All the President's Men.
It was a Haldeman operation. The whole business was run by Haldeman, the money, everything. It won't be easy getting at him. He was insulated. You'll have to find out how.
Be hard to find that one in the rental stores this weekend. There's more coming up, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Early this year, the European Union launched a new market where a precious commodity is traded. Companies that need this commodity pray that they're buying at the right price at the right time and don't get caught short. Speculators and hedge fund managers prowl for quick profits. Well, that precious commodity is carbon dioxide, more accurately, the right to send carbon dioxide out of factory smokestacks and into the skies of Europe. Carbon dioxide is the prime ingredient in global warming, and most scientists say the world faces a climactic disaster in about 50 years unless industries start cutting back now. When this market was launched, a ton of carbon dioxide cost around €8, which is about $10. But yesterday, the market closed at around €20, or $24 per ton. Joining us to explain all of this is Joel Bluestein. He's president of Energy and Environmental Analysis in Arlington, Virginia. Hello, Joel.
My pleasure.
And can you just walk us through, European polluters now trade carbon credits. Explain to us the European trading system.
Well, the whole idea of trading pollution is something that's been developed over about the last 10 years, really, in the United States. And it started with the 1990 amendments to the Clean Air Act. And it started with sulfur dioxide emissions in the United States related to acid rain. And I think when people say, well, now they can pay to pollute, that's true, but the flip side of it is it costs them to pollute.
Well, and explain how this credit system works.
So you set an absolute emissions cap, so many tons per year, and no matter how many new plants are added, no matter how much they run, that cap is the cap. And you create a new kind of currency called an allowance, which is a permit to emit one ton. And then you distribute those allowances to all the affected units. And the system is very simple. There's one rule. At the end of the year, you have to hold enough allowances to equal your actual emissions.
Okay, well, let's put some numbers on this. So let's say in Europe, the allowable emissions limit is something like 44 billion tons for all of Europe. Then that is divided up among the countries in Europe?
That's right. It's divided up among the countries and then among the individual affected units, which include power plants and iron and steel mills, paper mills, and a few other industry segments.
So very simply put, the people who have low emissions, who come below their cap, have some extra chits to work with.
That's exactly right. They can sell them to others who are going to be above their limits. So it gives them a huge amount of flexibility, and it creates an incentive to lower your emissions so you have some allowances to sell.
And just if you can paint a picture for us, how does it work? Is there a marketplace? Is there sort of a Wall Street equivalent of the European carbon trading system?
Well, each country has its own program. So they have their own system of allocating the allowances, monitoring the emissions. Monitoring is very important because you got to know exactly how much was emitted to know how much you have to sell or buy. So each country has its own monitoring program, and some countries have a better track record of monitoring emissions. And then each one has its own registry, and that's where the exchanges take place, through an electronic registry. And so none of those registries today is fully operational, and some of them aren't operational at all, which is one of the things that makes trading difficult right now and makes the market so volatile.
I was going to ask, how well do you think the system is working?
Well, it's just beginning, and it's going slow, and there have been, you know, bumps along the way, but generally it's moving forward, and I think it will work pretty well. But it's also just like the stock market. There's volatility that comes about just because of the philosophy of trading. And so when something changes, like last week, the Italian plan was approved, but at a lower level of allocations, fewer allowances than were expected. So that caused the price to jump up a little bit.
Well, as you said, the hope of the trading program is that companies will have the incentive to reduce their emissions so that they have these extra credits and they can sell them and make more money. How do you reduce your carbon emissions?
Well, and that's a very difficult thing. That's the challenge of CO2 emissions. We don't really have the technology to remove the CO2 from the exhaust and do something with it. So we either need to do less, which nobody really wants to do,
produce
be more
less,
efficient, which is great if you can increase your efficiency, or to shift from a higher carbon fuel to a lower carbon fuel, from coal to gas or from gas to wind and so on. And a lot of the compliance is expected to take place by shifting from coal to natural gas. But with natural gas prices increasing in Europe, just as they are in the United States, suddenly the cost of that fuel switch is higher than people might have expected a few years ago when this program started to be developed.
I was going to say, does that in turn drive up the carbon prices, because carbon speculators see that there aren't that many options for users?
Exactly.
Well, Joel Bluestein, how important is it in your view that this trading system work?
It's a very important experiment, and if it totally fails, I think that's going to put a big kink in the whole idea of international trading. So it is very important.
Well, speaking of kinks, our understanding is that many European countries felt there are some kinks in the system right now, but the problem is so serious, let's get the system started. Whereas the Bush administration's opinion seemed to be, let's make a better system before we start doing anything. Your thoughts on that tact?
The climate science is pretty clear that we need to make very large reductions in the long term. And it's true that we don't really know how we would do that today. But the problem is that until you have some kind of mandatory requirement, companies are not going to start to make the kinds of investments that are needed to develop the technology and get it in place that in the long term gets us to where we need to go. So my view is that you need to have that driver in the near term, but you have to start slowly. We don't really have the technologies or the methodologies to make big reductions today, but we could start slow and send the signal to companies that they need to start making that investment.
Of course, if companies started to see other companies in Europe making money on this, it would also be an incentive.
Well, and the other thing is that, you know, there are going to need to be some fundamental changes in technology and some fundamentally new technologies put in place. And the question is, who's going to develop that? Is that going to be U.S. companies that develop those technologies and then are able to sell them to the rest of the world? Or is it going to be companies in other parts of the world that are forced to develop those technologies and then are able to sell them to everybody else and the U.S. has nothing to offer?
Joel Bluestein. Joel Bluestein is president of Energy Environmental Analysis, an energy consulting firm in Virginia. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The approximately 400,000 frozen embryos currently stored in U.S. fertility clinics remain a hot political issue. Much has been written about the issue since President Bush, flanked by the so-called snowflake children, children born from unused frozen embryos, promised last week to veto a measure that would restore federal funding for research involving the stem cells of new embryos. And yesterday in a Rose Garden news conference, the president once again defended what he calls the culture of life.
The culture of life is more than just, you know, an issue like embryonic stem cell. It's promoting a culture that is mindful, that, you know, that we can help to help save lives through compassion.
More on that in a moment, but first to another front in this debate in Italy, where new Pope Benedict is also wading into the politics of frozen embryos in ways that could have an effect in the U.S. On Monday, Pope Benedict told Italian bishops that they should instruct Italian Catholics to boycott an upcoming referendum on Italy's tough new law tightly regulating fertility clinics. If not enough Italians vote, the tough law stays in effect. Well, joining us on the line from Rome is Tracy Wilkinson, the Rome Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. And Tracy, the Pope spoke briefly on Monday. What exactly did he say to Italian bishops?
Well, he essentially endorsed their campaign to discourage Italians from voting in the referendum. If, as you said, fewer than 50% of eligible Italian voters come out to vote, then the referendum is dead and the law stands. And so he endorsed their efforts to keep the turnout low and to allow these very restrictive laws to remain on the books.
And tell us what the laws say.
The laws do a number of things. They forbid the donation of sperm and egg for infertile couples. The law, in addition, bans embryo research and restricts the number of eggs that can be harvested and fertilized and implanted into a woman who is trying to get pregnant through in vitro fertilization.
To only three.
Sorry?
To only three embryos.
To only three.
Mm-hmm.
Well, more can be harvested, but only three can be fertilized,
mm-hmm.
and then all three must be implanted in the woman. They cannot be frozen. A fertilized egg, an embryo, cannot be frozen under this law. And it bans any screening, any kind of genetic screening for disease or genetic flaws in the fertilized embryos.
Well, Tracy, how are Catholics reacting to this?
Well, it's a very mixed reaction. I think, you know, Italy, while traditionally a Catholic country, is increasingly secular. Italians don't go to church that much. They don't heed the words of their priests all that much. Abortion is legal. Contraception is legal. So this law, in a way, kind of went back for many Italians saw it as a as a step backward, because it does impose restrictions where there had not been. Now, that said, I should say that Italy was kind of infamous for its lack of regulation on in vitro fertilization and all kinds of fertility practices. I mean, this is a country that gave us the granny births, if you recall, women in their 60s who could have embryos implanted in them and become pregnant, and doctors who talked about cloning babies. And so there, this is always called the Wild West of fertility medicine. So even those who oppose the current laws felt there should be some restriction, but suddenly Italy had what is considered the most restrictive legislation in all of Europe.
And Tracy, before we let you go, has the Pope taken a stance yet on the hot topic here, embryo adoption?
As far as I know, no, he hasn't yet. I think everyone is sort of waiting for a Vatican pronouncement on embryo adoptions. I mean, their basic stance so far has been that embryos should be preserved, not destroyed. Therefore, they don't like having embryos fertilized and then sort of put on shelves. They're trying to move that. But in terms of adoption, there isn't, as far as I know, a pronouncement yet.
Tracy Wilkinson, Rome Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Tracy, thank you.
Thank you.
And now with like a quick U.S. perspective from Peter Canellos, Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. And Peter, as you know, the Washington Post is speculating that the Pope's stance on this issue could drive a wedge between some Catholics who oppose in vitro fertilization and evangelical Protestants who are promoting adoption of frozen embryos. It's sort of a complicated division. You write that there's another wedge that could be driven within the evangelical anti-abortion community. What is that?
Well, I don't think that all pro-lifers view in vitro fertilization with the same level of suspicion that the more extreme elements of the pro-life movement do. There are a number of people who oppose abortion, for example, who feel that in vitro fertilization in giving otherwise infertile couples a chance to have children is actually an enhancement of the right to life. So within the pro-life community, there are divisions over this issue.
Yeah, well, and you also write that President Bush's participation in this topic, holding the so-called snowflake children, there's been so far 81 children adopted from these embryos that have been abandoned at fertility clinics, that it signals something. You're not sure what, but at least raises questions about the future of in vitro fertilization. What are those questions?
Well, I think the White House event last week was designed to back up the president's threat to veto the stem cell legislation, essentially by saying that these frozen embryos really are children. You know, that the embryos are living things and they're children waiting to be born. But the implications of regarding frozen embryos as life are quite serious. So, for example, could those embryos ever be discarded if we regard them as life? Should we allow couples to create them and freeze them in the first place, mm-hmm. if we regard them as life?
Which again, the Italian law bans.
Which the Italian law bans. And then the question is, you know, if there are leftover embryos from fertility procedures and doctors feel like that sometimes is necessary to help a woman conceive, what if the parents don't want to have them adopted? I mean, what if the people who created the embryos don't want to have some third party come in and take them and give birth to what are essentially the biological children of the first couple? Mm-hmm. These are all ethically difficult areas.
And questions that, as you said, are just starting to be raised. Well, just in the few seconds we have, how do you think the Pope's intervention in the Italian case will affect U.S. policy, if at all?
Well, I think it will in that it'll bring the issue to the attention of American Catholics, and so you'll hear more Catholics in this country speaking out against in vitro fertilization.
Or for, if that be the case. Right? Peter Canellos, Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Peter, thanks for helping us keep an eye on this.
Thank you, Robin.
And you are listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. We spoke recently with Mark Zanger, restaurant critic for the Boston Phoenix, who, after tasting the food at several Boston-area school cafeterias, pronounced it dismal. That brought this comment from K.G. Glenmire. I am a registered dietitian, she writes, who's been the food service director in a Boston school district for 18 years. School meal menus are based on the U.S. dietary guidelines and are full of nutrient-rich foods. A colleague once told me it's only nutritious if they eat it, but that being said, I am proud of the 20,000 meals we serve in 42 schools to many kids eligible for free lunch. We provide a safety net for these kids as they strive to meet their academic goals. We also spoke recently with Judy Davids. Her son had been killed in Iraq, and Judy asked us if she could speak with the reporter in Baghdad who'd witnessed her son's death. They spoke for several minutes. Craig Markin of Tucson, Arizona, wasn't sure if he was comfortable with the public nature of their talk, but he writes, "In this interview, I recognized family members looking for meaning in a meaningless loss and searching for sense in a senseless war. I recognize these as I went through the same experience 37 years ago with the loss of my brother in Vietnam. My heart goes out to all of these families." Newsweek magazine's report that a Koran was flushed down a toilet in Guantanamo Bay has, as we all know, been retracted. But Pat Westwater Jong of Bolton, Massachusetts, called to say Newsweek should not be the focus of the reporting.
It appears that, in fact, there was a desecration, has been desecration of the Koran at Guantanamo Bay, and I am extremely concerned that what our current administration does is blame the messenger rather than taking responsibility for atrocities. They should take feedback from this and not allow desecration of the Koran.
Thank you for calling, Pat. On Memorial Day, we reviewed some of the best war movies, which drove Walter Carrington to his keyboard. He writes, "How could you have a discussion on war films and not even mention what is regarded as one of the best films ever made, All Quiet on the Western Front?" Also overlooked was Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece on World War I, Paths of Glory. I saw it soon after coming home from my army service in Germany in the late 50s. It is as powerful a statement on the futility of war as any I have seen. And many of you responded to my essay about springing my 81-year-old mother from the hospital rather than risk dangerous open-heart surgery. Eric Arvidsson was one of many healthcare professionals who wrote to say how sorry they are when they see the elderly waiting in overworked hospitals trying to make decisions about healthcare. His advice, don't second-guess. You can only do the best you can. Well, John Bridges also wrote, he says, "A few years ago, my 84-year-old mother's hip failed, and we took her to the emergency room for several hours of wait and see, similar to your experience. Then they recommended a hip replacement operation. Unfortunately, I let them do it. It was successful in itself, although within 3 days, a blood clot dislodged from somewhere and caused a stroke from which my mother did not recover. Considering her otherwise reasonably good health prior to the hip, I wonder if simply letting her live with it might not have been the best. Anyway, thank you for your story. When I heard it, I said a little prayer for you and your mom. Hope you get the most out of the summer adventures you've planned." Well, thank you. And we will, because we'll be listening to a lot of this band. Cassandra Camp of Westboro, Massachusetts, wrote us after our piece on the retro cocktail lounge band Pink Martini. She says, "I discovered them after seeing the movie Mostly Martha. I love their sound and wit. My second favorite thing about the band is that they are one of 6 pieces of music to transport you to another world in the Bush Survival Bible by Gene Stone. They have been transporting me in grand style for going on 5 years now." When you are near, everything's clear. Earth is a beautiful. We love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Is there a link between healing and noise? A report by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation last year showed that the daily noise of the hospital can be hazardous to your health. Loud paging systems and beeping medical devices reduce worker productivity and increase accidents. Well, Yvonne Adams is not a healthcare professional, nor does she research noise in hospitals, but she knows the power of music. When she was younger, she used to play in symphony halls. Now, at the tender age of 77, she has a regular gig at a hospital in Portland, Maine, playing for patients. Ms. Adams tells her story to producer T.K. McQuirk.
My name is Yvonne Adams. I have been playing the violin for 70 years. Years. I started when I was 7 years old, and I'm 77 now. In the beginning, I would rather go out and play with the boys, but I was told to practice 1 hour a day, which I did. And in the long run, it paid off. With music, it's very true that you use it or lose it. And I don't have the technique I used to have. I wish I did, but I do what I can. Every Thursday, I go into the Mercy Hospital with my violins. My old friend out here. And I play for the patients room to room. I generally get in there around 9 or a little before. A little rosin on here. And I never know how long it'll be. It's according to the census how many people are in the hospital. My garb, so to speak, my logo, is a t-shirt and velvet slacks. Some people object to that, but I like to be comfortable when I play. Okay, we start over here. I have to make a regular route. Either that or I forget and go into the same room twice. I don't want to do that. When I was young, I had to borrow violins. I had an old violin that wasn't much good. It didn't have much sound to it. But I managed to play. I play it anywhere and everywhere. I got into every orchestra I could find. Portland Symphony, I went in there when I was 14. I auditioned. I think I was the youngest.
You have a favorite song?
Oh, it doesn't matter. Oh, yes, I do. But I don't know. You might know it's a Protestant hymn.
What is it?
What a friend we have in Jesus.
I think the violin is the most spiritual instrument, and I think it awakens something in a person, something that may not be quite prominent. And of course, it brings back memories, which sometimes is a blessing to have people think about something that happened before and not what's happening now.
Wunderbar. I'm going to be operating on him in about an hour.
Are ya?
Yeah.
I remember you in my prayers.
Let's see. What.
Nobody there?
Well, we won't play there then. If they don't want it, that's fine. Many are in pain.
Can I play something for you?
I don't want to give them any more pain. One time I went in and there were amputees. That's very hard for me. I'm a diabetic. And I worry about the same thing happening to me. The gentleman was being rehabilitated and was going to be fitted for limbs. I could talk with him. The second, the poor fellow was just screaming. So all I could do was stand at the foot of the bed and pray and hope that his pain would subside. there. I think I'll sit down just for a minute.
It's a very tiring experience at times. Sometimes I'm in there five and a half hours. If I'm there that long, when I get home, it takes me generally a couple of days to recover.
They treating you okay in here?
Huh?
They treating you okay?
I've got quite a few friends that I see every once in a while. They come back. Sometimes they're diabetic. Sometimes they're heart patients. And I think a great deal of every one of them.
No. I'm waiting now to find out what time I'm going home.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I have to play Going Home.
And when anyone goes home, I generally play Going Home. That's Dvorak's Going Home. They seem to like that. I told them that going home is the best medicine, even better than the pills. And they agree.
I'm a volunteer. I play music if you want it.
I want it.
You want it? Okay, you got it.
Well, the violin has been a companion since I was 7 years old, and it's been a source of comfort, pleasure, and amazement sometimes. If everyone played some music, what a different world it would be. And it's true, I think.
It's good.
Thank you.
I love my music.
Our story was produced by T.K. McGirt while she was a student at the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies in Maine. And we leave you today with these thoughts about what continues to be the big news story of the day, the revelation that the Watergate informer known as Deep Throat, whose identity has been kept secret for more than 30 years, was in fact former FBI official W. Mark Felt.
I knew it was Mark Felt. I thought it was, and I've told people that for a number of years, that he was the individual who had both the information and who also had a motive. He'd been passed over as director of the FBI, and he was full of bitterness and resentment.
It involves the entire U.S. intelligence community, FBI, CIA, and justice. It's incredible.
I think it's a great moment in American history. It's a great moment for our family, especially for my dad.
This was always Nixon's worst fear, that the FBI didn't like him and they would go out to nail him. And this was one of the reasons he was motivated to cover up. Well, he might have been right.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
What is somebody going to go on the record in this story?
That last was actor Jason Robards, who portrayed Washington Post editor Ben Bradley in All the President's Men. Before that, President Richard Nixon, John Dean, W. Mark Felt's daughter, Hal Holbrook, who played Mark Felt, or Deep Throat, and Nixon ally Patrick Buchanan. And now someone has revealed and gone on the record as to who is Deep Throat. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.